Welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast, a podcast incorporating narratives about facing and navigating adversity, a mixture of people, their experiences, and professional psychological discussion. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn Cirillo. I'm a qualified and regulated psychologist with over 20 years' experience of mental health, disability, and human behaviour. I want to share people's stories of navigating adversity in the hope that through being heard, a dose of compassion and some understanding, we can help others in the face of adversity too. Hi, and welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn Cirillo, and super excited today. I have a lovely guest that I've met not that long ago, but we've really connected, and this is such an important topic. So I'm going to introduce Rose and let her tell us a little bit about who she is and what has brought her on today.
Oh, thanks, Tara. So I'm Rose Rokins. I'm glad you didn't try and say my surname, because normally people try and say Rawkins or Rawkins, and it's a new name for me. It's a married name. So Rose Rokins.
Welcome.
You know, row your boat. And yeah, thanks for having me on.
It's lovely to have you.
Oh, it's so good to be here. I am I'm many things, but the reason I'm here is because I'm a suicide prevention trainer. And I have been for nearly 10 years now. 9 years ago, I started this particular thread of my career. And at the time, I was working as a counsellor, so working mainly with teenagers. And I was also working for RISE, the domestic abuse charity. So I was working a lot with women as well who were living with or had survived domestic abuse. But I'm not currently working as a counsellor. I'm focused now entirely on training. I train counsellors, I train doctors, I train teachers, all in, tools, how to have the tools and the confidence to talk about suicide. So in order to have a conversation essentially that could save a life. And that's what I do, and that's what I love doing. I live and breathe it. Mental health's been my world for 20 years. And so suicide prevention just feels like somewhere that I need to be now.
And I can see that. And we've met before, haven't we? Because you're helping me with something else that I'm working on. And I can see the passion. Which I think is probably, if it's all right to say, useful as well, because it's a heavy subject to tackle, isn't it? And
it is.
No doubt you'll be hearing and holding things.
Yeah, I hear that a lot. I guess when people I say I work in suicide prevention, people say two things. One is that people say, wow, that must be depressing. Or they say, wow, that's really niche. And I guess it's a good point to just gently dispel both of those myths, because it might sound depressing, but for me, I choose to see it as the opposite. I mean, I do this work because it's hopeful, because I go into a classroom, whether that's an actual physical classroom or, you know, somebody's offices or on Zoom, and people, and I help people move from a place of fear to a place of actually, no, I'm going to give that friend a call that I'm worried about, or I'm going to have that conversation with my colleague. So in a way, it's for me the opposite of depressing. It's actually really empowering and hopeful. And I know that people leave saying, I feel better now, because now I know I can make a difference. That's really important to bring in,
that hope element. But also, if there's someone listening, and hopefully by the end they'll know a lot more about how to start having those conversations and how to find you to learn more, is that actually it isn't something to be scared of then, and to be fearful, that we can all start a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the fear that stops people talking, isn't it? And that's basically become my life mission, is to remove that fear. And just on that second point, that people going, oh wow, it's really niche, they very quickly realize, oh no, yeah, it's not, is it? It's completely universal, because it's really human. It's really a human part of us to consider suicide. Many of us have, most of us probably have at some point considered it, acting on those thoughts. That's far fewer, but it's kind of part of being human, is to kind of think about it, and so it's not niche at all, you know. And that's why my work takes me from, you know, I always quote this week that happened, I think it was like 3 years ago, where in 1 week I was training staff at Westminster Abbey in one day, and then start, and then all the some of the prisoners at Wandsworth Prison, like in the same week. And so Westminster Abbey, Wandsworth Prison, nice little W. But you know, it's like everybody from all elements of society.
That word, I'm going to bring it in, but kind of normalizing conversations. And it doesn't sit well with everybody, that word, but that actually doesn't matter who you are. People experience this, and we can have conversations. And something you said right at the beginning, it can save lives. So that's why we're here. That's why we're talking about it. Yeah. It's not just about informing people, it's that it creates change. And we know that from the work that you're doing, and we'll come on to that in a little bit, won't we, that this works. And it's something that anybody listening today, whether on a train, in bed, whatever, you can take something from this and you could make a change. Yeah. Kind of simple as that, really. So can I ask a really bold question then?
Sure.
Why is it that we find it hard to talk about suicide? What is that? How do we deconstruct
that? Why is it so hard? I mean, yeah, we could go on about the stigma and the taboo and all that. Of course, that's still present in our culture, in some cultures even more so. But there's that. Yes. But I do think that's changing. I do think we're more open to, you know, COVID helped in that way. You know, that question around self-harm, that conversation to the point where if we said to anybody, how are you? And someone went fine. It was like, well, no, you can't be, because nobody's fine. So let's actually go to the crux of how you really are. So I think COVID did a good job of us actually opening up those conversations. And I do think stigma is lessening. So why don't people want to talk about it? I think because it just taps into that really, really dark place that we all have, and we're probably all really scared of. If anyone, I mean, I've thought about suicide at times in my life, and it is terrifying to even think about what that felt like, let alone to, you know, consider that I might feel like that again. It's horrible, and it's uncomfortable, and it's scary. And so I think one of the reasons we don't want to talk about it is because it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel nice. And when we're sitting with somebody who is facing that reality, is considering that suicide could be the answer to the pain that they're in, you know, it's a really hard place to be, because it taps into something of our own as well. And yet we kind of almost have to go there. You know, there's that phrase of like holding space. It's very clinical word. I'm sure we use it a lot as counsellors, therapists. And what I teach is not counselling or therapy or psychology or anything like that. But it is about, can we just sit with somebody in their pain? Can we just sit with them and not try and fix their problems? It's really, really hard. Of course it is. But it's also what does save a life. And not for hours, but we're talking like, this is an intervention. It's like a first aid thing. It's kind of 5-10 minutes of exquisite listening and just having somebody not on their own in their most perhaps darkest times.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's something
we don't change it.
Sit, not fix. I'm going to stay.
Sit, not fix.
Stay with me. Yeah.
Yeah. Not sit, not fix. We don't need someone to fix our problems, do we? Because it's really disempowering when someone tries to do that for us, really patronizing. Yeah. And, you know, actually we just listen to me, you know? Yeah.
And I wonder whether that in itself is what puts people off. Do you think that maybe, and I'm sure there is something, I just see in my own clinical work as well, that in the British culture particularly, we're not great at sitting with tricky stuff. There may be, you know, wonderful negative thoughts that come in about, what if I don't know what to say? What if I get it wrong? What if I don't know how to fix it? That actually, what we've learned already then, that it isn't about fixing it. It's just about sitting and holding. And it might be difficult, but that we all have that ability to do that. Have I got that right?
I think that's right. Yeah. And I think what you're really starting to highlight or see is that you know, that there's fears on both sides. There's fears of like, I'm worried about a person. I know I need to reach in, but I don't know how to. And there's all those fears of saying the wrong thing, making it worse. Yeah. But in terms of the, you know, this isn't to say there's a them and us, because we could obviously each of us could sit on either side of this conversation at any time.
That's important, actually.
Yeah. But if there's you know, if somebody is thinking of suicide themselves, why aren't they reaching out? We always say, reach out when you're struggling, to call me anytime. Why aren't they? Because there's their fear of they're afraid of maybe making the other person feel bad. So there's that, I don't want to be a burden on you. There's that fear of if I start to share how I'm feeling, that I'm going to make you feel worse. I'm also terrified about your reaction, because what if you can't listen to me and you can't hold space, right? I don't want to be told what to do. So there's that fear of being, you know,
really
sort
good
of
point.
Control being taken away from me. And then there's the fear of like the overreaction and the underreaction. So what if I say something and it becomes a conversation about suicide, and you overreact in a way I don't need? You panic, you call 999, you bring loads of people in really quickly, and it's out of my control.
Absolutely.
That's a really real fear. Or the opposite, you know, what if I tell you how I really feel and you laugh or say, oh, come on, what have you got to be, you know, so upset about?
Absolutely. Which happens, doesn't it? You know, that could be incredibly invalidating.
A million reasons why if somebody doesn't, because they don't feel reassured, adequately reassured, the conditions are not there for somebody to be honest. and vulnerable. So often
there is something about vulnerability then, and I've just actually had a really little Tara thought that popped in my head while you were saying that, that there may be people listening to this who want to learn how to start a conversation if they're worried about someone or just want to check in with someone. But also there may be people listening to this who are actually actively having thoughts or have done, who actually can benefit from hearing how do you manage that, you know, that actually if I share, what can that mean? And that viewpoint can be useful for the people that are asking and checking in, you know.
And it goes back to that, there's no them and us, you know. So when I'm training a room of 30 people, they're all there because they are wanting to be, you know, to upskill and be helpers, and they're already probably in some sort of helping profession, but that could include things like bartenders, you know, who are also in service, and we train them too. So but any but you know, actually people come and often will in time share that they also have thought about suicide, or might even be at that time, because we can flip-flop between the roles, and actually you can learn so much about it, helping others by learning to help yourself.
I've learned loads already. That concept then of, you know, that it isn't one side or the other, it's kind of fluid, is that the right word? I think actually that can be really useful for both sides to consider that at any point. And actually, I'm just wondering, you know, people that are booking on, there may be an extra motivation there to learn for themselves, or, you know, sometimes, as you say, people go into the helping profession, sometimes they've had experience, or
often,
you
know, they have. Often. I mean, on my counselling diploma, I think all of us had had, you know, we were all in need at times, because we're all human. I think that's very and I experienced that when I've trained, you know, a room full of doctors, there is a sort of barrier up at the beginning, and there's kind of a, well, what can you teach us? There's a sort of but there's also a, well, we're okay, we're the fixed ones, we're gonna be here helping them. And
how helpful is that? Because I'm just wondering, there may be other people, you know, in fields now, psychologists, we're all guilty of, I'm okay, I've got all my, you know, everything, I've got my skills, I'm okay. We're sometimes not okay. And actually, I think it is really good to learn to be vulnerable and not to have those kind of defenses up all the time.
I mean, absolutely. I think it can only possibly make you a better practitioner if you're okay with saying, you know, I'm doing my best, but also I've got supervision, and I will sometimes need to take a break for myself, and I'll recognize when that is, and I've done the work on my, you know, and you know, I need to take a week off because I need to look after myself before I can better look after you. I mean, I would, when my counsellor has done that in the past, I have respected and so appreciated it, because I'm like, well, you're also a human being and you're not perfect, therefore I also have permission to not be perfect. And it's just all modelling great behaviour.
It really is. There's so many great points already. I could go off. We could always do a podcast episode on each one. So there may be people listening that kind of go, okay, like, if I did start a conversation and I lent into all that tricky stuff, how do we know if this works? How do we start to look at, like, evidence-based? Because some people might question it and go, is it going to make a difference? Big, bold question.
And it is the hardest thing to prove preventative work, isn't it? Because how on earth do you prove what doesn't happen? Because what we hope is that as a result of my conversations and my training, essentially, and or our training, we're a big team, that something doesn't happen, that somebody doesn't take their own life. So how on earth do you measure what could have, it's a sliding doors thing. The only way is really is stories, isn't it? Anecdotes. We try to gather stories from people after they've been on our training. Last year I got 3 direct messages not long after delivering training, which, I mean, I see as evidence. One lady wrote to me and said, this is like sort of film like stuff, I literally talked someone off a bridge after I took your training. I had the confidence to go up and talk to somebody, and I'm not sure I would have done before. And so there's that. Somebody else said something similar. 3 days after I took your training, I think I saved somebody's life. They were a little amazing. And someone else had said that they'd walked into a bar and there was somebody in the bar was on their phone in tears, a stranger, and this person who'd taken our training kind of hovered around them when they got off the phone and said, are you all right? Can I help? Is everything okay? And they wouldn't have done it. They said they would not have done that if I hadn't done this training. There was spidey senses. I just wanted to check in. And sure enough, the person had been on the phone to an ex-partner, and there was a potential suicide situation, and they weren't alone with it anymore. So they then had somebody to bounce off and to talk through the next steps. And you know, so I mean, incredible. I think it works. I mean, that's three stories there.
Well, I was going to say, when we first met, I looked at some of the testimonials on your website and I was absolutely blown away. Because as you say, it's not just that you know that your training works, but also I think it's helpful for other people to see that. Look, that if you lean in, you know, lean into that vulnerability, do the training, start to learn how to do this and then put it into practice, it really can make a huge, you know, actually seeing human stories, it can be different, can't it, from a kind of a list of why it might help. Because is it all right to ask, you shared a story recently in your social media and it just got me. I was actually walking to work and I actually stopped in the street to read the rest of the reel rather than reading it later, because
you're reading your phone as you walked.
Reading my phone as I walked, which I do. I'm very guilty of that. And literally I was like, that could be, and there was something about it. Is that something you're comfortable talking about? Because I just think those kind of examples are what will really make people think about
It was the most extraordinary morning. Well, except it wasn't. It was the most ordinary morning. I was just on my way back.
That's what got me. Yeah.
I was on my way back from the gym and I was like, oh, I should probably post on social media later. I took a little selfie just in case. I mean, I'm trying to get better at this stuff. And and I bumped into a neighbour. I don't know them well. They said something about, oh, I'm not great actually. And I instinctively stepped back and went, oh, don't want to get what you've got. Ha, you know, let's chat from over here. And something about the way they responded said, oh, yeah, no, not great. Actually struggling. I think that they used the word struggling. Yeah. And I realized that I'd taken a step back when actually what I wanted was to take a step forward. And I just said that to them. I said, oh, struggling. I misunderstood. I thought you meant physically unwell. In that case, do you want a hug? And they said yes, and they wanted a really long hug. It's not somebody, like I said, that I knew well, but you know, you get obviously consent for these things first, and it just felt, absolutely. I mean, it was amazing. And then we spoke for about, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. It wasn't long. Like I said, it's not counseling sessions, but they were really struggling and they were thinking of suicide, because I asked directly, which is what we teach on our courses. You must do, if you're thinking about, oh gosh, maybe that's what they're trying to tell me.
We ask
permission to use the word, permission to say yes, you know, create the conditions for honesty. And you know, together we came up with some, I think I described it as gentle doables. You know, just what's next steps then? What, you know, you're not alone with this anymore. Now I know as well. So where do we go from here? And it's where do we go from here as well? I mean, like I said,
words can be really powerful.
And I shared it not thinking much of it, and it struck a chord with you. It struck a chord with a lot of people. I've had a lot of messages from the back of it, and obviously I'm still checking in with the neighbour and they're doing fine, you know, they'll be okay. But I had a lot of messages from people saying, you know, they wish everybody could just stop and do that. And that's literally like solidified my mission. I want everybody to be able to stop and have that conversation on the street. It's not that scary.
So,
but it's not rocket science. It's doable.
Sometimes, you know, when we're in threat mode, our brains do overthink things. I'm not going to be able to do this. What do I say? I always share, I'm sure I must have done this on a load of podcasts, but the school path is always the thing, you know, typical psychologists observing everything. But how many times you might say to another parent, how are you doing? But you're still walking. You know, it's the how are you doing, almost like a tick box. And sometimes you might mean it, but you're not stopping and allowing the conditions for them to then think and really tell you.
And so the only possible answer in that is, it's fine, fine. And then it's gone.
Isn't it? But that, like you say, I think there was something when I was reading, it literally stopped me. It sounds a bit cheesy, but you know, stopped me in my tracks. Because usually if I see something I like, I'll be like, oh, I must make time to read that properly later. But I was like, no, I need to finish this. I need to finish the story. And there's something about how, as you say, how ordinary that day was. You know, this wasn't someone you'd been concerned about for a while. And I wonder whether sometimes with suicide people think it has to be that it's this build up and that you're checking in. It can literally just be saying hi to someone, how are you, and then it could come up. You know,
a really good point. I guess for that person it had probably been building up and up, but it was interesting. I think they even were taken by surprise that they were suddenly opening up. And there was an apology, and I'm sorry, I can't put all this on you. I shouldn't be burdening you with all this. And
so that's back to your point earlier that people might not want to share because they're worried.
So, you know, just a lot of gentle reassurance of, well, you know, I'd rather I knew as well, so that you're not the only one who knows about this, about these thoughts and this danger that you're in, because it is a dangerous place. I'd rather that you weren't alone with it, because then we can also bring in some others, and who else, you know, who else needs to know this? And
I was going to bring in that bit. That's a really good point, because there may be people listening, and I know I've certainly come across this before when working with significant others of people that I work with, is that, but what if we have to involve other people? What if I'm stepping outside of trust? And I think actually let's bring that tricky stuff in as well, because that could be a barrier to someone asking.
Totally.
What if I don't know? Yeah, that kind of, so you know, if you're there, you have a situation, you've got a friend or anybody, could, and it could be a stranger, the lady who gave the example of literally talking somebody off a bridge, it could be anything on that spectrum.
Yeah.
What could it look like in terms of keeping them safe, involving other people?
So to be clear, you must involve other people.
Yeah.
If suicide is part of your conversation, and if somebody's thinking about it, but that's really hard, because you've built up trust with somebody over the, you know, 10, 15 minutes or longer, you know. So it's about choosing your timing, you know, not being like, so we ask the question, are you thinking of suicide? If the answer is yes, quite often that's when people panic and go, right, who else can we call?
Yes.
What we teach is, hold off on that, like, listen first, build some more trust, build some more rapport, don't leap. They're safe, they're alive and they're safe because they're talking to you. So there's, what's the hurry? Slow it right down, and actually the trust can actually be broken if we leap too quickly into, who else can we call?
That kind of problem solving mode dominating.
So you know, ask the question, if it's a yes or it's a no, you know, don't run away, it's just the two of you for now, and that's fine, that's important. But look, when the time is, you know, 5-10 minutes in, you want to be starting to say things like, this is really big, you know, this is big, and you know, we're just two people, who else should we talk to about this, because you know, we need more help here, we need more help. And even if, you know, you as a psychologist or I'm, you know, counselor, that's still not enough. It's not enough.
Absolutely.
That I'd be the only one left holding those.
And it's useful to let people know that we wouldn't do that either in a clinical kind of therapy setting.
No, never. A line that I often use is, I say to someone, look, I can't promise confidentiality, I can't, but I can promise total transparency, and that you have control over who and how we talk to now, like how we have this conversation. You know, I can promise you a whole load of stuff. I can promise that you lead the way now, and you make the phone call to your GP, and I can sit beside you. And I promise that, you know, if you want to call the Samaritans now, and we recommend that we do it right now, just so you've broken the ice and you've done it once, I can speak first if you want, or, you know, I can promise that you're not alone when we do that. And there's lots you can promise, but holding it alone, me being the only one, I can't promise, because if, God forbid, if anything happened to you now and I'm the only one that knew, I could never forgive myself, because you're too important for this. And actually, I'm too important. I'm not going to put myself through that. So we need some backup here. We need some more people. And in my experience, people, by the time you've not just come in with that too quickly, you don't break the trust by doing it too quickly. Most people are like, yeah, do you know what? I do need more help, and you can help me do that now. And it all just feels doable. It's like not so scary anymore, because you've already, for them, modeled one way of them telling their story, and you've heard it. And then you say, well, others can do that too, and they need to, you know. So who else are we going to call? Is it going to be your partner, your best mate, your GP, a helpline? You know, let's pick a few and get them all on the phone one by one.
Helping them with their decision making, but you're not making decisions for them, and it's very different from problem solving, isn't it? You're just holding a space, helping them make informed choices. I love the language that you use, just slightly, you know, changing the wording, just taking a moment. And I guess that will come with time, and you know, leaning into your own vulnerability, that sometimes when we panic we might race ahead to what we need to do, but just taking a little pause, taking a breath and changing that language, you know, what do we need to do? I love that. You know, what might need to happen, rather than come on, we need to get you to, you know, that kind of directive. And it's still safe. I think sometimes people worry that, you know, if they don't act really quickly, or, you know, they're not overly directive, it's not going to work.
No, I think that's all doable.
Anyone listening now can do that. You know, rewind this and then play that back. we need to put the audio typed out as words as well, so people can see. It's really useful for people to hear, isn't it?
And you know, it's the same thing when it's a child or a young person. You know, we think we need to take a lot more control. But again, what's, you know, actually sitting down and just even breathing with the young person, should we just take some big deep breaths? And
what might be different? So if you have younger age groups, then what might be different?
I do a lot of training in schools. I did some last week at a local school. Yeah. And it's interesting because their safeguarding lead, actually, they always say if a teacher is, or any staff member is doing, let's say, a suicide intervention with a child, they say safeguarding needs to know by the end of the day. They're very clear about that. They don't need to tell me immediately, because they recognize that trust, you know, you don't need to get safeguarding straight into the room within 5 minutes. Of course you don't. It's much more important you build up the trust with that young person.
Absolutely. Look,
depending on their age, you might of course need to involve the parents, but there's ways of doing that where the child can still feel in control.
Yes.
And of course always having in mind that if the parent is part of the problem, then we need you need to really consider how that happens. And it might be that it's a different family member, but that's where the school's policy and procedure comes in, and you've got to work within that. But I think it's something about just not leaping to take power out of a person's hands, almost regardless of their age. You know, it's, you know, what do you need? Who do you need right now in your life? I'm just one person, but we are going to have to get some others. So who do you think? Who are your safe people? Who are your safe adults? And letting them have control over that is absolutely life-saving.
That's so important then, because I'm wondering whether there is a bit more of a presumption that when it is a child or a teenager that you need to be more directive. But again, just that considered is a word that popped in my mind, and then it's just a little bit more considered in how you approach it.
I mean what you do often get, this is generalizing, but what you sometimes get with kids or teenagers is quite a lot of shrugging and I don't know. So you might have to be more directive just because of that, but it doesn't mean we don't at least offer them the choice and the control first. And it might be that directive means, so look, here are some ideas, what about this or this? And then I've got a toddler, right? So it's not, you know, you don't say brush your teeth now. You're like, if he's like refusing, it's like, look, do you want to brush your teeth now or in 5 minutes? I don't mind. It's your choice. So he thinks he's got some sort of power and control, but you know, the teeth will get brushed.
Never.
So there's
but
kind
again,
of
it's the language, isn't it? And the tone.
Yeah.
It's really important.
I think saying, you know, well, I'm taking this, you know, I'm telling you what's going to happen now. Of course, there are times where that needs to happen. Look, if somebody is, you know, talking about suicide and they're drunk or doing something or they're psychotic, or if there's a situation that's like a crisis situation.
I was going to ask that, if there's kind of an impairment of function, as we call it, something that would maybe make you doubt their ability to take on information or make safe, informed choices.
Yes. I mean, if somebody is acting in a really, really dangerous way you're not having a calm conversation with them, sometimes it is a case of, you know, I'm calling 999. Of course,
and that's okay.
It's okay. You know, absolutely. But what we hope is that you're able to have a calm conversation, you know, far before it gets to that crisis point. But sometimes you don't, and sometimes it is, you know, that you do what you have to do to keep somebody safe. But I guess what you want to always look at is what is the lowest possible level of kind of control or directing that I can do to keep that person safe and yourself safe as well. Let's be really clear.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Never put yourself at danger as well. But I think what the point is that, for example, 999 is like such a last resort, and it can be used far less frequently than people think. Most conversations about suicide don't end up in a 999 call. They end up in maybe a call to make a GP appointment for the next few days.
That's important for people to know, actually, because I'm not sure whether most people know that. You know, if you're new to talking about suicide, or you're not already working in a profession like ours, that's really important.
It's more about building those kind of community links, and you know, what is it that where makes you feel safe? What piece of music do you want to listen to when you get home? And you know, what's your favorite blanket? And like, literally, it's these kind of comfort things that are going to help somebody to nurture themselves and to feel safe. And look, if you don't, you know, if you are not wanting to be on your own, who can you call? Let's get some people named and make sure they're on. Let's get them on the phone now. And always having a 24-hour helpline as part of that package.
So it's like almost kind of multifaceted. Sometimes in our kind of line of work, you great, what you call a kind of a safety plan. So it's, that sounds like the beginnings of that. You know, what do you need when you get home? Who can you talk to? 24-hour a day support in addition to that, and kind of building up a framework.
Yeah, it's exactly the same. Exactly the same.
Also that, presumably then, for people that might be new to that, takes some of the pressure off you holding it as that sole individual that's been told.
Yeah. And that's the aim by the end of any conversation, that you are not the only one holding that information. And it's for your own safety, but more for that person, that they've been very much in danger if they've been the only ones with those thoughts and not possibly kind of giving out signs to other people, but consciously or probably more likely not consciously. But until they've actually had an open conversation with somebody, that risk is so much higher. But the risk goes right down when we've just had somebody say a thing so bad that you're thinking of suicide, because I've noticed you say this, I've heard you say, what's the point? I've noticed you're withdrawing. Yeah. And it's just on my mind to ask you that because I'm worried. And if somebody says yes, you know, okay, inside we might be panicking, thinking, God, holy shit, can I swear, sorry.
And that's really normal. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're rated as explicit because we're mental health, so it allows for it.
But knowing that actually you've just done the most important, powerful thing to keep that person safe, and they are instantly safer now because they're no longer alone with those thoughts. And that's really powerful. And really,
when you just said that, then reduce risk. It is that easy to reduce the risk. And just the compassionate, the wording you use is really strikes me as well, because I don't know, is simple the right descriptor, but it's not, you don't have to overthink this. They're really lovely, compassionate, everyday words that you use, and it works, and it reduces risk, in a nutshell.
That's literally, I mean, I've spent quite a lot of time thinking about sort of my values, you know, and clarity is one of them. Clarity, compassion, communication. They all start with C, actually. But it's really important, because I think especially around things like psychology and you know, mental health, there's often quite a lot of jargon that comes with it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Literally, so unnecessary.
You don't need any other barriers.
And that it is a barrier, because sometimes people think, oh, I can't do that. That's not it. It could be. And I'm just thinking, actually, in terms of, because we need to bring in where you started with your wonderful business that you run, is, you know, moving away from that jargon. So start a conversation. It's as simple as that. Tell us a little bit then. How did you start it up? And then what do you do? Because people need to hear about that.
What a journey. I mean, I don't know where to start. I've worked in mental health, isn't it, really? Since I graduated, but used to be used to work for a publisher, a mental health publisher. And I remember promoting these books. I was in the marketing department, and this is when I was back in my 20s. Oh, at the same time, I was a Samaritan. I'd become a Samaritan at 21, which is unusual. But we'd lost a really close family friend when I was a teen, and I think I was always on my mind to learn more about that and learn. So early 20s, I guess I sort of started, because I was on the phones at the Samaritans and then selling these mental health books. And I remember thinking, this is great, but I don't want to be selling them. I want to be reading them. I want to be writing them. This is, and you know, you fast forward to 30 years. I'm not that old. Fast forward 10 years to my early 30s. I'm training as a counselor and looking at my reading list. Oh, these are all the books I used to sell. So, you know, it's interesting how life kind of comes like full circle like that. My 20s, 30s, I was a teacher. I was training as a counselor. I was driving a camper van around for a few years, stopping and teaching English, where, you know, just all sorts of, you know, you do these things.
Immersed in life.
But basically the thread that always went through all the jobs I was doing, from teaching and mental health frontline worker, was always around people and helping. For a few years. So I'm in Brighton, and for a few years I was running an incredible project for the YMCA called Safe Space. I think it's still running. If you know Brighton, it's on West Street, which is right where the big party scene is on a Friday and Saturday night. And it's a little church hall, and I used to manage this incredible service. It was one of the proudest moments of my life. Safe Space literally does what it says on the tin. It was a place where the you don't call them bouncers now, door staff I believe, would bring people in who had been kicked out of the club or was so paralytic drunk or, you know, lost their friends, lost their phone, lost their sanity temporarily, really not in a good space.
Safe space, yeah.
And they'd come in. We also had a beach patrol. So occasionally I'd be out on beach patrol with my colleagues and we'd literally be stopping people walking into the sea. You know, we'd be checking when couples were having sex on the beach that it was consensual. Like, we'd literally stop people. But it was a really, and if needed, we'd take them back to the safe space and there's lots of coffee and chocolate biscuits and get people home safely. It was open till 4 a.m. And at the time, I was already learning to teach a course called Assist, which is a 2-day suicide prevention training, which I recommend everyone does, but not everyone has the 2 days. So shorter courses are available. But I got made sure the whole team was trained up in Assist. I can't remember the order of events. Anyway, at some point then I was working as a counsellor and with working with young people. You know, suicide and self-harm just started becoming sort of mostly what they were bringing, you know. I was just wanting to learn more and more. I ended up as one of the managers of the city's wellbeing service for young people, and then COVID hit and I went on maternity at the same time, and start the conversation just sort of I don't remember the day I went, I'm going to start a business, because it wasn't really like that. It was creeping in anyway. I was starting to do more and more freelance training. And now it's just what I do. And I've got, you know, brilliant colleagues. Nobody does this work alone. So I've got more work than I can do. So I often give it out to people, friends, colleagues who do similar work, because the demand is high. Need to know. Yeah. And I think are ready to know how to talk about this stuff. So, you know, hooray, finally, at last. I'm kind of trying to do myself out of a job so I don't need to be training people, because it should just be common knowledge.
That's the compassionate you know, that wonderful hope that more and more people will be able to lean in and start those conversations.
Yeah.
So you run training courses, don't you? I want to make sure we will put all of this in the show notes. If people go, well, I need more Rose, and they're going to do that, where do they find you? Where do you hang out on social?
Where do I hang out? there's so many ways to answer that question, but in terms of professionally, I am on LinkedIn, so Rose Rokins. You can find me there, and my website is starttheconversation.uk. Australian and American. Stop the conversation, Jack. UK. I don't know why I'm speaking like that. If you look under suicide prevention training, there's one called TAS-10, which is one of my proudest achievements. It's a 90-minute program, which is soon to get CPD accredited. We're really thrilled about that. TAS-10 stands, the TAS part is talking about suicide, 10 tools. And it's a 90-minute program. You can't do everything in 90 minutes. Of course you can't, but you can dispel some fears and you can teach 10 tools, and you can also hear an example conversation. So you're actually in that 90 minutes, you hear scripted conversation of how it can go.
That must do to kind of alleviate fear of, well, what does this look like, sound like?
Yeah. And so when we run our open courses, we've got a whole bank of these, like we call them life-saving conversations, and those have been created by a charity called Ollie's Future, who I'm sort of affiliated with in this way. So they create these conversations, and then we use them in the training. With the open one, we tend to use the bartender scenario, because everybody can relate to being in a bar, and you know, that how that conversation can, you know, literally happen in a bar. But when we deliver TAS 10 to medical students, which we do now, it's on several curriculums.
It's amazing.
We don't play the bartender one. We play a conversation between two medical students in the university library. It's kind of the same conversation, but it's tailored, and it means that people can go, oh yeah, that's me, I can do that. Similarly, we've got a doctor version and a teacher version, and all kinds of versions. So, you know, the training can be quite easily sort of tailored to particular groups.
Accessible, so, isn't it? You know, it's not kind of, you know, it's all right to say a lot of training these days can be really kind of rote learnt. Yours is really bespoke. You hear, it's very kind of grassroots, if that's all right to say. You're hearing what people need, what it could look like, and you're using that. And I think that's why you just kind of resonated with me when we met. It's very different. So I would urge people to just go and spend time nosing around your website. Look at those testimonials, because they really stand out, don't they? It makes a huge difference, doesn't it? Do you know, the thing that's really struck me today as well is actually, you know, obviously you go in and work with different groups. There were some that I had presumed probably we could really benefit from training, but what I hadn't thought about is all the people, you know, the baristas, bar staff, hairdressers, people who are hearing our stuff without us really realizing it, that can also benefit.
Yeah, I think of them as like the sort of unofficial therapists of our society, because they do. People tend to talk to a hairdresser, right? You're sort of stuck there. You can't really go. You're not looking them in the eye often, maybe a little bit through the mirror occasionally, but it's not too confronting.
Yeah.
Bartenders.
Just who you can reach. So, you know, literally shameless plug, but it needs to be done. If you are someone listening and you think the people, your staff or your boss, go to them and get them to go check out your website, because it's that kind of, you know, people don't know that they don't know it. So listen to this podcast, and the whole point of this podcast today is that, you know, you may be in a professional industry where you haven't even thought about training your staff in conversations or bringing that in.
And you might not have thought about it because it might not have happened at your workplace. And I guess the thing to say is that so often, sadly, we get called in to come and train, you know, the staff at a school or a workplace because a colleague has died by suicide. And for that person and that whole, you know, everyone who knew and loved them, it's too late. Of course, it's never too late to have training. But, you know, let's do it before that happens. Let's create workplaces where it's okay to talk about it.
Preventative, as you say. Yeah. You know, that kind of going full circle. You've given us like 95 nuggets. You get 90 if you do your training. But can you leave us with one little adversity takeaway? If there was one little nugget you could leave us with, what would it be? That's my little signature move. Show my age.
Oh, I wish I'd known that signature move.
Sometimes people, I've let them have two.
Oh, gosh, an adversity takeaway.
What would you want someone to take away? They're on a train now and are just about to get off. They're just about to drift off to sleep. What do they need?
I guess what I would say is, if you're on a train right now or you're in public, look up from your phone. No, that wasn't a jibe at you. I do it too. Yes. But I try and do it. But look up from your phone and smile at someone. That sounds really cheesy, but there's a town somewhere in Finland where they experimented with it. In fact, they experimented after the loss of a young person by suicide. I think the parents started this huge campaign where it was like, can we just start smiling at strangers? And there was this incredible impact on the well-being of the whole town. Smile, you'll get a smile back. You might get you're a bit weird, but who cares? It's a story. Smile. And look, if you don't get a smile back, you know, a little, you're right. You know, you just don't know what could happen. I just think we've just got to stop being so bloody British and start getting a bit nosier.
All right.
And start getting curious and like really checking in with each other. And if people are like, yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, but are you really? Because so checking, asking twice, just being afraid to have that awkwardness with a stranger. Who cares? Better to be awkward than for somebody to not be here. So that's my takeaway.
It's like one of our best ever takeaways, that lean into that awkward, that cringe, that I can't do it, whatever.
Yeah.
Do it anyway.
Do it anyway.
And how good will you feel to know that you could have made a huge difference to someone? But also, a little double whammy, how good is it to know that you can embrace some of that fear and make a difference as well? Because that might then open the way for us to do it again. So everybody then, smile. I'm going to go and do that after this.
Smile, embrace the cringe.
Not on my phone. Rose, thank you so much for coming on. Literally, I could do about 5 episodes with this. Such an important subject. This episode's coming off the back of another one. We have a lived experience of suicide. So I'm really hoping that those two episodes together are going to make a massive core shift for people in thinking about suicide. Let's use the word. You notice we've used it a lot. We haven't kind of danced around that either. Let's use the word, you know.
Yeah,
thank you really so much, Rose. It's been amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Tara.
Thank you for listening to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quintarillo, and it's been lovely having you along to listen to this episode. If you want to find more about me, you can find me at drtara.co.uk. So you'll see everything I'm up to, my media work, my collaborations, my clinical work, if you're interested in that. And of course, all the other episodes of the Adversity Psychologist podcast. If you're interested in coming on, you can also contact me and let me know what you would like to come and talk about. I love love to hear from you.